said you're having a hard time finding psalms that relate to family. There's a lot of fighting in this psalm. He talks about his enemies. So today, again, we're going to focus on the habits of faith. And so before we get into tonight's habits, first want to review, if anybody would like to. I'll just chime in that today we had a meeting in Starbucks, and I made sure that everybody in the meeting went and bought something from the... that we shouldn't, because we sat there for like 2 hours in the, you know, in Starbucks. Maybe you have to buy something every hour you sit there. I'm not sure, but it was definitely the awareness and the consciousness of it was really, really good. And people were like, really? You should buy something? You don't have to. Like, hey, you don't have to. Of course you don't have to, but it's a nice thing to do. So does anybody have any reporting to do on habits, yes?
Well, you know that in the Christian church they have a thing called tithing. Well,
I wonder where they got it from.
Well, in many churches, at least the one that I belong to, you make a commitment at the beginning of the year, and you fill out a pledge card, and you say what it is that you're going to do for the remainder of the year, and then you're given the envelope. In my personal life, I've had some specific financial difficulties, and I tend to put that last on my priority list. For my commitment, and having strictly through my discussion last week, is that I've made it first on my priority list, so that I can fill out, okay, what's my budget for this month? What's the first item on my list? So that's the commitment. So far, I have followed it, because I've only been doing it a week. That's my promise to God.
Beautiful. That is great. That's very nice. Anybody else want to share any of the habits, or especially last week's habits? Okay. So that's good, because we want this to impact our lives. That we shouldn't just hear it. We should absorb it. And we have a statement in the Talmud that a good thought, if you think of doing a good deed, but unforeseen circumstances keep you from doing the good deed, God considers it as if you did it. So just by making the commitment, that's already a good deed, and then hopefully you can follow through, which is the second part of the good deed. But making the commitment itself is already a good deed. Well, today, we're going to continue with this idea of focusing on habits of faith and understanding more the story of Noah and Noah's relationship to his family. And then we're going to get into relationships, family and relationships in general. So let's start first with philosophy, and then we'll get down to practicality. So the first thing is, we've talked about this before, but is Noah a tzaddik? Is Noah righteous or not? And we kind of talked about, well, he was righteous in his generation, but, you know, compared to other generations, maybe he wasn't so great, and we kind of talked around the issue. But bottom line is, was he righteous? Obviously, he was righteous. How do we know? Because God said so, right? God says he's a righteous man. So if God says he's a righteous man, he's a righteous man. But then we get to the story that we're going to really be delving into today, and that is where he finally leaves the ark. Right? Now, he gets out of the ark, and that's on page 39. It's chapter 8, verse 15. And so God spoke to Noah, saying, this is after the land had already dried, Noah had independently sent out his spies to determine whether or not the land had really dried. He sent out the birds. Some of the birds didn't want to go. Then he sent out the other birds. And then finally, he knows that the waters have subsided and that it is now, the earth is fully dry. But yet he does not leave the ark. He's still in there. And in verse 15, God spoke to Noah saying, "Go forth from the ark, leave you and your wife, your sons and your sons' wives with you. Every living being that is with you of all flesh, of birds and of animals and all moving things that move on the earth, order them out with you, and let them teem on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." Noah went forth, his sons and his wife, and his son's wife with him, every living being, every creeping thing, and every bird, everything that moves on earth came out of the ark by their families. What's the first thing Noah does when he gets out of the ark? He brings a sacrifice. So then Noah built an altar to Hashem and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. Parenthetically, what is a clean animal and a clean bird? Kosher. Kosher. Kosher animals. So Noah knew about kosher animals. This is hundreds of years before Abraham is born, and it's many hundreds of years before the Torah is given, where the Jewish people are actually told about the laws of kosher. Just, I wanted to bring to your attention that the ideas of kosher, the ideas of Sabbath, all the ideas that we find that God gave the Jewish people during the Ten Commandments and after, really, the Jewish people knew about before. These were not things that were revealed at Sinai. They were simply commanded at Sinai. But they were known before. And so Noah knew about the kosher animals, because God told him the kosher ones take seven of each. Right? Seven males, seven females. They had 14 of each. So he's got kosher animals in his. So he knows. Noah knew what a kosher animal was. Now, why did God tell him to take so many animals that were kosher? He knew it must be that God wants him to bring a sacrifice. And so that's why as soon as he gets out, he brings a sacrifice of the animals. He figures if God wants him to sacrifice, elephants, he would have told him to bring seven elephants, but he didn't. He told him to bring kosher animals. Now, someone asked the question of what is the definition of a kosher animal. So the kosher animal has to have split hooves and has to chew its cud. And so that goes for, cows. Actually, a giraffe. A giraffe is a kosher animal. We just don't know how to slaughter it, but it is a kosher. It is a kosher animal. It does split its hooves. And it has split hooves and it does chew its cud. There are only four animals that we know of that only have one of the signs. The pig has split hooves, but does not chew its cud. A camel, and there's one species in the rabbit family and one in the weasel family that they chew their cud, but they don't have split hooves. But other than that, all animals either have both or have none. Okay, so he goes ahead and he makes a sacrifice. That's the first thing that he does, is he makes a sacrifice. Doesn't do anything else. That is the first thing that he does. Hashem smells a pleasing aroma, and God says in his heart, "I will not continue to curse again the ground because of man." And then God says, "It's not man's fault. Man's heart is evil from his youth. So why would I get upset? Why would I get upset at man?" And so he promises, "I will never do this again. Continuously all days of the earth." Verse 22. "All days of the earth, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, shall not cease." Which is an interesting, another parenthesis here, another interesting statement. Why would God make a promise that the seasons would stay? That's because during the flood, the seasons stopped. How long was the flood for? The flood was for 1 year. For 1 year, there were no seasons. There was no day, there was no night. What does that mean? Just from a scientific perspective, what does it mean that there was no sun, the sun didn't shine, the moon didn't go? What happened? How could the world exist without seasons? Which is kind of difficult for us to understand. What does it mean? But according to the Torah, according to the Bible, God makes a promise that never again will I let the season stop, or day and night to stop, because that was horrific what happened to the world. And so God makes a promise that he would never do this again. And so there's a very interesting letter that I read that was talking about the age of the universe and saying how it's impossible for us today to determine what really happened if we weren't there at the time of the flood. If what the Bible is saying is true, not if, but if we are to understand what the impact of no seasons would be on everything in the world, how would that affect the physical structure down to the atomic, subatomic particle level? How would it affect the world? We simply don't know. So we don't know what the world was like before the flood and what the world was like after the flood. And we talked about this a little bit last time, that the world changed. Human beings, according to some opinions, changed. Before, they couldn't eat meat. Afterwards, they could tolerate meat. They could, all of a sudden, they could digest meat. That's according to one opinion, but it gives you an attitude that the human being changed. If you look at the age of man shrinks in half. It goes from the people living 900 years. Noah himself lived 950 years. He wasn't the oldest man, but he was close to it, or the longest living man. And it goes down to, precipitously drops down to 400 years, 300 years, down to 120 years. Very quickly it goes down to we know today as the lifespan of a human being. So things dramatically changed. What did it do to the molecular level? What did it do to the subatomic level? What's the radioactive change that happens to a universe that goes through the kind of flood that the Bible describes? And then how would we determine now, if we're going to now study the Earth, if we're going to study things, and what kind of changes would happen to the topography of Earth if these things happened? All the ice caps would melt. I don't know what would happen if there would be no seasons. Everything would freeze. You could have in 1 year, you could have a deep freeze. You could have everything melting. I don't know what would happen. What would that do to the ecosystems around the world?
Global warming.
I mean, you could have. And by the way, it's not a joke, because according to the Midrash, the Midrash says that when the windows of the sky opened up and the water came pouring out and the fountains from the deep came up, what it says is that it was boiling hot water. The water was boiling hot. And I just read a study, a finding that they did about a couple of years ago, that there is these gigantic volcanoes that are erupting underneath the sea, and they're pouring boiling hot lava, which is literally warming up the waters, which is the cause of the waters, the temperatures in the waters rising. And I was thinking to myself, could you imagine if at the times of the flood, it says, not just in one place, but the world became so hot that according to the Midrash, there needed to be a miracle that Noah could survive. That's how hot it was, that the ark could not survive. Now the question is, how did the fish survive? We have a lot of questions that come up, but we don't know. And the Bible is simply describing to us a phenomenon that we simply don't have any measuring tools to be able to measure what effect this would have had on the world and what it could do to the aging of the world. So just wanted to throw that in parenthetically. Okay, so Noah gets out of the ark, and the first thing he does is, thank God. First thing he does is he builds an altar, because he knows that the first thing you do, first thing in your day, the first thing in your life, the first that everything should always be, put that on the top of your priority list. Not the last thing on your list, but the first thing on your list. We have a concept in Jewish tradition, and that is Hidur Mitzvah, which means beautifying a mitzvah, which means spending more money on a mitzvah, which is a commandment, even a custom, than you would spend on other things. So some people, you know, spend their money on their cars. Some people like to spend money on art in their home. Some people like to spend money on furniture. Some people like to spend money on clothing. Some people like to spend money on food. Everybody has different things that they want to spend their money on. And some people are cheap in other areas. You know, they're frugal here, and they're spending here. You know, some people would like to invest their money. Other people just like to go to shows or other things. Everybody has their own pace and lives their own life. Well, according to the Torah, to show what's really important, spend money on the mitzvah. So if the mitzvah is to put a mezuzah on your door, don't just put up the cheapest mezuzah you could find, almost like Cain and Abel, right? So Cain just, whatever, the cheapest thing he could find, and he makes a sacrifice out of it. Abel goes and tries to find the best. So if it comes to always put it on the top of your priority list, not at the bottom of your priority list. When I've used up all of my money for all the things that I really need, whatever's left over, I'll give it a donation. After all of my time is used for the things that are important to me, then if I have any leftover time, I'll volunteer, I'll go and study, I'll pray, I'll do all the things that if I have extra time. It should be the opposite, which is why the first thing in the morning we should get up and pray. Show that that's the most important thing. Not, if I have extra time, then I'll pray. And so the first thing that Noah does is he walks out of the ark, sets up an altar, praises God, thanks God by offering a sacrifice. Then God gives him a blessing that he should go out there and be fruitful and multiply and fill the land. And so it is an obligation upon man, God says to us, that it's our job to be fruitful and multiply and fill the land. So the reason we have children, getting to family, is because God said so. Because God said, have a family. God said, have children. Not that we have children or have family because of the convenience, because of companionship, because of they make you feel good, because they're so cute, because they're, who else's pictures are you going to look at? Do you look at somebody else's kid's pictures? You need your own kid's pictures. Whose graduation are you going to go to? How are you going to keep yourself busy? Who's going to take care of you when you get older? You know, you have all these reasons. That should not be the reason for having children. The main reason for having children is because God said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the land. It's a biblical God command to have children. This is our way of fulfilling God's wishes, which is not to live for ourselves, but to live for a purpose. What is your purpose? Not you. You are not the purpose. You are here to serve a purpose. And so how do we show that? We show that by serving others, by serving our children, by serving our spouse, by serving society, by serving God. So this is how we show that we're here for a purpose. This is our purpose. And so God says, go out there and be fruitful and multiply. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens and everything that moves on earth and all the fish of the sea. In your hand they are given. And so God here gives them the permission that they're now allowed to kill animals. As he says in verse 3, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. Like the green herbage, I have given you everything. But flesh, with its soul, its blood you shall not eat. And so here, God is commanding all human beings that when you kill an animal, you must wait till the animal is dead before you can eat from it. And this is where we learn the rules, one of the seven Noahide laws that I keep on mentioning. One of the seven Noahide laws is that not to be cruel to animals. The specific law is you're not allowed to eat the limb of a living animal. So as long as the animal is alive, you're not allowed to eat from it. Which means, even if the animal has been slaughtered, but it's still moving, you have to wait till the animal is completely dead before you partake of it. And so this is a problem, because many times they don't wait for the animal to die before they already start turning it into food, which is a problem. And so from a Jewish perspective, we have to wait until the animal is dead before anything is partaken from it. Then the next one, again, goes into the next of the seven laws. However, your blood which belongs to your souls I will demand, of every beast will I demand it, but of every man, for that of his brother, I will demand the soul of man. Whoa. What was that? Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God he made man. And so God says, listen, I'm asking you to be fruitful and multiply. I am giving you permission to eat the animals. And just because I'm giving you permission to kill an animal doesn't mean that you can take the life of an animal lightly. And just because I'm allowing you to take life, you have to be able to distinguish between life. There is the life of an animal, and there is the life of a human. And so don't get confused. And now that I let you kill an animal, that now you can go kill a human being. And so therefore they come one after the other as in connection. Before I gave you permission to kill an animal, so you couldn't kill an animal, for sure you can't kill a human being. But now that I've given you permission to kill an animal, you might think, well, a human is just a higher form of animal. Right? We're 96% the same, like a same DNA as an ape. But that doesn't give us any permission, because just because our DNA is the same doesn't mean that we're the same, because we talked about that during creation, that the way the human being and the animal were created was different. God blows into the human being, because the human being serves a purpose. The animal is used for a purpose. The animal can be used for a purpose if it's used as a sacrifice, if it's used to create food, or to plow a field or things like that, or even companionship. The animal is serving a purpose, but it itself cannot do anything purposeful. Someone else has to take the animal and use it for something purposeful in order for it to serve a purpose. The human being is the only being that has free choice, and therefore can choose, and therefore when they do something, it is with purpose. Whereas the animal is simply just doing what it was created to do. So therefore it does not serve a purpose. It's pretty clear that capital punishment is definitely something that the Torah speaks of. Throughout, it's the only punishment that's mentioned in every single one of the five books of Moses, which is the punishment of death, of killing someone for a sin. So the idea of taking someone's life because they did something wrong is something that there is no, you won't find any objection in the actual Bible. You'll find support for that, complete support for that. The question is, who is to determine that, and how do you make the determination, and what do they have to do in order to deserve it? So that's where it gets quite complex and complicated. But it's quite clear that there is no one can say that the Bible is opposed to capital punishment, because it's quite clear that if you read the Bible says that if somebody does these kind of sins, those kind of sins, punishment is death. So it's quite clear. The question is, what's the criteria that we use in order to determine if someone is deserving of death? Okay, now you got to get into deep, Talmudic, complicated, really complicated stuff, because sometimes it's very difficult to actually execute someone. So in the law, it's quite in the written Torah, it's quite clear that death is a punishment. But then you read the oral Torah and you find out, it's not so easy to execute somebody. You need such proof, and you need such, it becomes a little bit more complicated. But it's quite clear that capital punishment is definitely in the Torah, in the Bible. Some say that even this refers to abortion, because the Hebrew word for whoever sheds the blood of man by man, the Hebrew word is ba'adam, which means in man. So whoever sheds the blood of man in man, which is the prohibition against abortion, because it's the man inside of a man. So that's another way of actually reading, because the Hebrew word is ba'adam, and the word the bet can mean by man, with man, in man. So it has multiple, that letter bet has multiple meanings. And so here is a reference to that. And he ends off, why? For in the image of God, he made man. So if you kill a man, you're actually committing deicide. You're actually killing God when you kill a human being. That's how terrible killing a human being is. Since man was created in the image of God, if you kill man, you're killing God. Another parenthetical thought here, but in Jewish tradition, when someone dies, we say Kaddish. Kaddish is a special prayer that is said by the mourner. And the mourner says these Hebrew words. Now, the Hebrew word Kaddish means to sanctify. And basically, it's a prayer to sanctify God. Great is the name of God, great is the name of God, may the name of God be blessed forever and ever. And talks about the greatness of God and the greatness of God's name. And so the question is, why would you say that when somebody dies? And the answer, one of the answers is because when someone dies, it's kind of like a part of God dies. And therefore, God's name, which is what each of us represents, each of us represents God's name. So God's name has now been lessened. It's now, it's become dimmer because this person has passed away. And so therefore we say, let God's name become great. We're trying to comfort God, and we're trying to understand that the human life is not just the loss of the family and the loss of friends and the physical loss. There is a colossal, monumental loss in the fact that a part of God just died. And so that idea, that thought in the concept of a murder, that when someone is murdered, God was just killed. Obviously you can't kill God, but a part of God was just killed. God invested in himself and created this human being. He blew from the deep inside of himself to create the human being, because the human being would fulfill the ultimate purpose for God. So therefore, God is so invested in the human being, you went and killed that? You basically killed God. And Jewish tradition says that by killing the person, that's the only way to truly help the person. That punishment by death is not vengeance, it's actually helping the person to cleanse himself of this terrible thing that he did. How do you cleanse yourself from killing God? What can you do? What can you do in your life that could possibly be the same as killing God? The only thing is to give your life up for God. That's the only way to make up for it. To give your life for God. Well, here, they're going to take it for you, but the idea is that you're giving your life for God. And that's the only way to atone for it. So it's more of an atonement rather than a vengeance that simply, you did something bad, we have to kill you because you did, you know, just justice has to be served. Here it's, no. You, the image of God. You struck the image of God. You killed the image of God. But what can we do to save you? What can be done to save your soul from what you just did? Okay, next in the next section, God promises he'll never do this again. And then we have the story of the rainbow. And then we come to verse 18. In verse 18, gets back to what happened to Noah settling into new life on a new earth, a new world. What was life like? And so the sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Ham being the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole world was spread out. Noah, the man of the earth, debased himself and planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk, and he uncovered himself within his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. And Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it upon both their shoulders, and they walked backwards and covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned away, and they saw not their father's nakedness. Noah awoke from his wine and realized what his small son had done to him. And he said, "Cursed is Canaan, a slave of slaves shall he be to his brothers." And he said, "Blessed is Hashem, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be a slave to them. May God extend Japheth, but he will dwell in the tents of shame. May Canaan be a slave to them." Noah lived after the flood 350 years, and all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Although it says here that he died, he doesn't actually die for many, 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 many pages left in the Torah. There's still a lot of stories. I mean, 350 years, he's going to live into the time of Abraham. Abraham isn't even born yet. Okay, so although it says he died, basically because Noah's purposeful living had basically come to an end at this point, and so it just says everything else that happened afterwards is really not Noah. He just happened to live, he continued living, but for all intents and purposes, this is the end of the story of his life. Well, let's now review, because this is really the subject of tonight, what we just read here, because it needs a lot of explanation.
Make sure I have it right. Noah was alive during the time of Abraham.
Yes, they were both alive at the same time, which is really amazing. If you'd like to see this very clearly, if you go to page 53, you can see on page 53, first of all, the seven Noahide laws. Eating a limb torn from a live animal, right? That was the number seven. But if you look down the list, so you'll see that Adam lived to the year 930. And then if you look down at Noah, so Noah was born in the year 800 and something. So he was born while Adam was still alive. I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. That was Lemah. So Noah is born just after Adam dies, and Noah lives until the year 2006. And let's look at Abraham. Abraham is born in 1948 and lives to 2123. So Noah lives 1656. 1996 was the dispersion. So Noah lives through the flood, through the dispersion, and he also lives for the first 50 years 54 years of Abraham's life. So it is possible that Abraham met Noah.
Fifty-four.
1948 till 2006. That's 54 years. No, 58 years. 58 years. Sorry, 58 years. They were together on Earth at the same time, and obviously Noah had a lot of people that he could have talked to that were alive when Adam was alive. So basically, we're talking three generations from Adam to Abraham, basically. The three generations, or the story didn't have to go through too much telephone, if you want to say. So we have 2,000 years of history, and basically three people are, you know, it's the length of three people's lives. So it was very possible to go back, and especially since the world was so small at that time, there weren't that many people, he figured that someone who lived 950 years, people knew about him. So people got around to see him. Okay, let's get back here to the story. So first of all, in the description of in verse 18, Ham being the father of Canaan. So it doesn't say Shem, Ham, and Japheth. It doesn't say their children. It all of a sudden tells us that Ham was the father of Canaan. Why? Why do we need to know that Canaan was his son? Obviously, because the story is going to unfold where Canaan plays a big role in it. We all know that the land of Israel, prior to it being the land of Israel, was the land of Canaan. So this is not just a person. This is a person who would take the holiest land and take it when it didn't belong to them. We know that the world was divided up by Noah. He gave his children three different continents. Japheth was given Europe, Ham was given Africa, and Shem was given Asia Minor, Middle East. That whole area was given to Shem. What was Canaan, doing in the Middle East? He didn't belong there. He didn't belong there. When the Jewish people came to claim the land, they said, it's our land. It's our land because shame. That's us. We are the rightful heirs to this land. You don't belong here. You belong in Africa. That's the land you were given. Well, they didn't like that. And so they had to have a fight. They had to have a war. But the war was a result of the Jewish people coming and just claiming what belonged to them. As a matter of fact, the fight between Abraham and Lot, right? Abraham and Lot, their shepherds get into a tussle. They get into a fight. Why do they get into a fight? Because Abraham kept muzzles on his animals when they would go out, because he didn't want them to pasture in lands that didn't belong to them. Lot, on the other hand, let his animals pasture in anybody's field. When confronted, he said, it belongs to us anyway. It's our rightful land, because we are the descendants of Shem, and we're going to get it later back. So they're just squatters. And Abraham said, you're right. But that's not a way to act. That's called vigilante. That's to be with the court of law. You don't just because you may be right, but you don't just go stealing based on a claim, even if you're right. You go to court, fight it out. Lot didn't like that. And so they parted ways. And where does Lot end up? He ends up in Sodom and Gomorrah, because he liked that kind of lifestyle of pure capitalism, which we'll talk about another time. So Canaan plays a major role because he's that land that he takes is the Holy Land. So the problems didn't start years later. problems start right over here. So what happens? So it says Noah debased himself. What is the Hebrew word for debased? It's vayachel. Vayachel means to be ordinary. Weekday. As opposed to holy and sanctified. And there I'm going to tie it into what we started before. All the way at the beginning. Was Noah righteous? Was Noah a righteous man? Oh, then he was a righteous man, but not now.
How do you apply righteousness? Hmm.
What's interesting is the Torah never says anything bad about Noah in this whole story. Right? No, in this story where he debases himself, it doesn't say he sinned. It just says he was ordinary. I mean, he says he got drunk and he was uncovered himself within his tent. But it doesn't say that he doesn't say where he sinned. Doesn't say anywhere he got punished. Yeah. Again, it says a lot of things, but in the Bible itself, again, he gets no censure for what he does. The only people who get censure or praise are the people who responded to what he did. So Canaan and Ham responded negatively. They get cursed. Shem and Yefet don't do anything wrong. They do something glorious. They get praised. They get rewarded. So just for purpose of conversation or just to put things in context here, we're going to talk about two levels of the Bible. There is the level of the Bible, lessons that we need to take, and then there is the level of the Bible where the Bible speaks on a very, very high spiritual level. And it's always important to keep that double vision when you are studying the Bible. And that's why the Bible is written in a most unusual way, with multi-layer interpretations, which are sometimes absolutely opposing one another. So on the one hand, we're going to say that Noah is a righteous man. On the other hand, he's a drunk. On the one hand, he is the greatest man of not only his generation, but of all generations. He was able to put up with the temptation of what was going on in the world around him, but now he's 600 years old, and by golly, he can't wait to have a drink. I mean, come on, it's like, which Noah are we talking? Will the real Noah please stand up? Is this a guy who's a real righteous person who can ward off all the temptations for the first 600 years of his life, but then he goes through the flood and now he's, and he made it through. And we'll talk about that in a moment. He makes it through the flood and there he is. He's done. He's so depressed, he's so off his mind, he just can't wait to get a drink. Something's wrong with the picture. And the answer is that the Torah is on two levels. Two levels. And that's because the Torah is talking to us. Humans. Regular people. So if the Torah just talks about holy people and righteous people, what lesson are we ever going to learn? We will not be able to relate to any of this. We'll just go, forget it. This is not a book for me. It's a book maybe for righteous people. I'll just close the book and walk away. When you start reading the book, you go, oh, got drunk. Oh, I can relate to that. Committed a murder. Oh, I relate to that. Oh, they stole. Oh, I can relate to that. Oh, he sinned this way. He did that. This is a book for me. So if I want to be able to relate to the Bible is written in a language that you and I, opening it up, read it and go, hey, it sounds just like me. At the same time, if that's all the Bible is about people like us, then what do we have to look forward to? It's basically, there's no hope. There's nothing to look forward to. And therefore, we have a second level of the Torah. A second level of the Torah is that the Torah is talking on a whole different level. And so when the Torah says that someone did something wrong, you can take it in two ways. You can take it that they did something really wrong on our level, or they did something wrong on their level, which compared to us would be nothing, but on their level was terrible. So if you're a righteous man and you decide to go and make a vineyard as the first thing when you come off the tree, when you come off the boat, for a regular person, that would be no problem. But for a man like Noah, that's the worst sin in the world. And once we have that, so what ends up happening is righteous people also make mistakes. But their mistakes are different than our mistakes. So what difference does it make what the mistake was? The fact is, we both make mistakes. So therefore, we have a lot to learn from the Bible stories. Because just like Noah makes mistakes, we make mistakes. And therefore, just like Noah is forgiven, we are forgiven. Just like he can rehabilitate himself, we can rehabilitate ourselves. So we can learn from the story. Because he made a mistake, I make a mistake, wow. I can relate. But let's not think, or let's not imagine that we and Noah are on the same level. If God says Noah is righteous, he was righteous. So then, how could a righteous man do something like this? Well, the Torah is describing it in a way that we could relate to it compared. So let's use this example. When a child does something wrong, it's wrong. It's a mistake. But it's very different when a mature adult makes the exact same mistake. Why? Because a child, you expect that from a child. But an adult should know a lot better. Well, how about if you're an adult and you do something that you didn't know? You couldn't have known. Well, then you're like a child. It's still wrong. So comparatively speaking, it's the same. Moses, the most righteous of the men of his generation, when he does one little thing wrong, that's compared to us doing something wrong. When Moses does this little bit, it's like us doing this big one. That's all. So we have to understand the ratios of the Bible ratios. So when Noah does something wrong, it's magnified on a big screen. So if you wanted to know how bad was Moses' mistake of hitting the rock, well, what would that be compared, like, on our level? What kind of a sin would that be like? If we would do the same thing as Moses, it would be nothing. But Moses, on his level, what's the ratio of what he did? The ratio of what he did is something so terrible that you wouldn't be allowed to go into the land of Israel as a result of it. What would you have to do in order not be allowed into the land of Israel? I don't know, probably do something really, really bad. Probably rebel against God or blaspheme God or do something really terrible in order not to go into the land. So Moses just hits the rock instead of speaking to it. That's like us cursing God. So the same thing. When each of the biblical figures does what they do, the Torah describes it. That's why it says Moses got angry, or Moses uses language that we can relate to. They tell the story of this rabbi, and since we spoke about this last week, you'll appreciate it, who was walking in the street and decided to go window shopping, which, as we learned last week, something righteous people shouldn't do, because you give the wrong impression to the storekeeper that you're actually interested in buying, and then they disappoint them when you don't come in and actually buy anything. So this rabbi, not even thinking about it, went and looked into a store window and realized afterwards, oh my gosh, I was window shopping. So he went home and he wrote in his diary, "Today, I stole." Okay, he dies, and somebody finds his diary. This is a rabbi? I can't believe it. Look at this. He said he himself indicted himself. He said, "I stole." Must have stolen. Okay, if you want to take it literally, sure, go right ahead. But on his level, for him, looking in the window was considered stealing. So when the Bible says that somebody did something, it says he stole, what level are they talking about? What level? And so the same thing here. What Noah did, for whatever reason, he made a mistake. He did something wrong. Shouldn't have done what he did. We can learn a lot of lessons from it. And we do learn a lot of lessons. But let's not for a minute think that he was some person who just went from just being righteous in God's eyes, all of a sudden descends to being, you know, somebody who can't control himself. So the Torah takes the mistakes of the righteous, enlarges them for us to see, places them on a big screen so that we can learn lessons from it. Because when you say, the rabbi stole, wow, okay, so number one, if rabbis can steal and repent, if I stole, I can also repent. But at the same time, I got to realize, I'm sure when the rabbi said he stole, he probably didn't mean he walked into a store and shoplifted. He probably did something on a very, very, on such a fine, nuanced level that for me that wouldn't be considered stealing. I do it every day. But for him, on his level, that would be considered this stealing. So it's important for us to look at the Bible this way, because otherwise you get a wrong message about the Bible. You start to think that the way it says it in the Bible and the impression that we're... Because we have to learn the lessons, and we have to learn the lessons of life. And so we learn these lessons from these righteous people making these mistakes, but at the same time, they were on a much, much higher level. Yes?
Well, if you take this all the way out to David, okay, he was a man after God's heart, right? And yet, he obviously did some pretty horrible things. Committed all these adults and all these things. So, where do you go with that? If you're talking about this,
So, that's the different levels, of course. So the story of David is a perfect example of the multiple layers. Double vision. And so King David didn't do anything wrong. He didn't commit adultery. He didn't commit murder. He didn't do anything wrong. But yet the Bible says he did it. King, the prophet, that prophet Nathan comes and gives him that example and yes, it's all true, and we can all learn lessons from it, because what King David did would be like us committing adultery. It would be like us committing a murder. But he, of course, didn't do anything like that. He was a holy man. Holy people don't do those things. Good people don't do those things. Seasoned people don't do those things. Regular people don't do those things.
You don't think I'm little.
Absolutely not. He did something that, compared to us, would be adultery. Just like the story of the rabbi who said, I stole. The rabbi said, I stole. Did he steal or did he not steal? On his level, he stole. On his level, that's stealing. It's not a joke. You see, it's not that he was making a joke about that he stole. On his level, that's stealing. But on our level, it's not stealing. How does it work with that story is a long story. They did a debate at the Jewish Center up in Irvine, and they had two lawyers. One was defending King David. Basically, King David was being put on trial. And so they had one who was defending and one who was the prosecution. And they asked myself and another rabbi to come in and kind of give our conclusion afterwards on what we thought about the story. And so this was another good example to be able to give them that double vision. That yes, on one level, you're 100% right. He committed and he did it, and he suffered, he repented, he did everything, and teaching us what we should do in case we do something similar to what he did, even though what he did was adultery on his level, murder on his level. he wouldn't do adultery on our level or murder on our level. So keeping that double vision is very important. I don't want to get too far into this. Maybe we'll take it up after this is over, because I know it's a juicy subject, but we gotta stay here and finish this up first. So what did he do? What did Noah do? So you said that he started off by planting a vineyard. What's wrong with planting a vineyard? It shouldn't be your first thing, that's all. No, it shouldn't be the first thing you plant, sorry. Not the first thing you do, but it shouldn't be the first thing you plant. Yeah, first you plant your meal, and then you make dessert, you know what I mean? You don't go to dessert first. You know, wine is the dessert. It's the flavor for the meal. It's not the meal itself. No, that's why if we were doing it, no one would ask any questions. But for Noah, he shouldn't have done it because of this. Now, Noah, by the way, had only good intentions with this. He wanted to sanctify the world. He wanted to use wine properly. But all good intentions don't always end in good results. And so here was a good intention, and he had very, very good intentions, just like King David had good intentions, just like all the people in the Bible had good intentions. And their mistake was that the good intention wasn't enough. It was what God wanted, which was more important. And so it's nuanced. And so here it is that Noah decides that he thinks that the most important thing is to go for the result. Go for the result. It's like I don't want to wait to get to the end. I want the end now. The end is when you celebrate. So I don't want to go to work. I don't want to wait till Saturday and have to wait till Friday to go. It's Monday. I'm ready for Friday. You know, I'm ready to take my drink. I'm ready to take off. So here he was after 600 years of working the flood. I mean, he's like, I'm done. I am ready to retire. I'm ready to get to the end. The grapes represented the end. And God said, there's still 350 years left to your life. You still have a whole life left to you. There's still a whole life left to you. Why are you starting off with something that's not productive? Start by planting things that are going to be, that are necessary, the basic elements of a society. Start building. That's what God said, right? The first thing God said to them is, you didn't survive the flood to go, phew, we made it through the flood. You made it through the flood to get to work. Go rebuild the world. I'm giving you the obligation to rebuild the world. And so instead of getting busy with rebuilding the world, he got busy with the pleasures of life. Hey, it's time to kick back and enjoy some of the things that God created. You know, it's been a long time. It's time to enjoy. In other words, the joy of life is in wine. It says in the Bible, right? Yayin yisamach levav enosh, that wine gladdens the heart of man. It's in the Bible. Don't ask me where. I still owe you I know where it is. This one I know where it is, yes. I think it's in 104, Psalm 104, I think.
My little thing when people ask everything during the Bible always say, I know what it says, I can't find the answer.
I have a good index in the back over here.
Psalm 104, 16.
So wine gladdens the heart. God said, I told you, go have children, have a family, build the earth. No, he's busy with planting a vineyard. So God saw that as something negative. He drinks the wine, and he gets drunk.
He drinks a little, he drinks a lot.
Where does it say that?
You start giving drugs.
Ah, you making drawing conclusions here. Who says how much he drank? It doesn't say how much he drank. It says he drank it and got drunk. It doesn't say how much he drank. Could be he drank a little and got drunk, or he drank a lot and got drunk. Whatever the case is, the result was not what God intended, that's for sure. He got drunk, and he was uncovered in the tent. And so Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness. What did he see? He saw him, obviously, on a literal level. He saw him without clothing on. He saw his nakedness. Saw him vulnerable. Saw his flaw. Saw him as a flawed man. As someone who made a mistake. He looked at him that he was not righteous. That's looking at someone's nakedness. Now, why does it say, Ham, the father of Canaan? Why is he, like, he has no name of his own. You know, he's always the father of Canaan. Like, who are you? Yeah, I'm my son's father. Who are you? This is my son, and I'm his father. And every time it says Ham in the last two verses, he's referred to as the father of Canaan. So obviously, Canaan had a big role in this. So either Canaan was the one who notified his father that Grandpa is drunk in the tent, and then Ham went and told his brothers, or Ham was the one who actually, I'm sorry, Canaan was the one who perpetrated the assault on Noah, and then went and told his father, and then his father came and saw, and then told his brothers, and so on. But whatever the case is, he was definitely involved. Now, I just threw something in there that the Hebrew word for nakedness. The commentaries say that seeing his nakedness was a euphemism. It was a euphemism for either castrating him or doing an immoral act with him. One or the other. So according to the commentaries, something very unpleasant happened at this time. According to the Midrash, which is interesting because it ties into what he did. According to the Midrash, the reason that he was castrated was they did not want him to have any more children. In other words, that Ham did not want Noah to have any more children. Like this, the world would be divided in three. If he has any more children, now the world gets divided. You know, you get your it's a big deal. You know, if you lose a quarter of your property and you have a small piece of property. Not a big deal. We lose a quarter of the world, that's giant. So here the world would be divided into three. Divided into four, you just lost a big chunk. And so we castrated him because we didn't want him to have any more children. So if we tie it back into the beginning, here was Noah, who instead of getting busy having children, building the world, what ends up happening, ends up doing something which distracted him from what he was supposed to do, and the result was he could not have any more children. He missed the opportunity. He could no longer do what God wanted of him, which was to actually have more children. So it was just that's an interesting twist here.
Well, that would explain your cursing him.
Yes, that's exactly why he curses him, and why he curses him so severely, which is why the rabbis say he must have, just to look at somebody's nakedness and notice that he was naked. He curses him like forever. He should be a slave, and he's cursed, and he curses Canaan, the grandson.
The grandson.
He curses the grandson. I mean, what did he do so terrible? He just told his father that their grandpa is naked in the tent. Obviously, he came to it. He realized what had happened to him, and he realized what they had done to him. And so this was the terrible, terrible act that was done to Noah. But the Torah tells us that the other brothers, they treated him very differently. And what did they do? They took a garment, And they laid it upon both their shoulders, and they walked backwards and covered their father's nakedness. And their faces were turned away, and they saw not their father's nakedness. What does that mean? If you turn away, you obviously can't see your father's nakedness. Seems like as a double expression. Ah. Not only, well, according to the simple meaning is that they actually had to turn around. I mean, you could walk backwards, but then to place it down, you have to look what you're doing. So they actually did have to look, but even when they looked, they did not see his nakedness. So that was on a simple level, they just did it and didn't look at the nakedness. But on a deeper level, the issue of how we view another human being. The way we view another human being is the way we want to be viewed ourselves. How would you like to be viewed? How would you like people to see you? Same way you'd like to be seen, that's the way you should look at others. What does that mean? I know my flaws. I know my faults. But I won't tell them to you. You know why? Because you'll think less of me. If I tell you my flaws, you will think less of me. Which is why you don't tell your flaws to anybody. Except to people you know who will accept you. Which is why teenagers usually have a very hard time talking to their parents, because their parents never understand them or accept them. And these are interpersonal problems where we don't tell our spouse because they won't accept us. And then walls start to be built up, and that's where relationships go. So what is the foundation of a relationship is how honest you can be and how supported you will be and how you won't think of me differently if I tell you this. You'll still think I'm okay? You'll still think I'm a good rabbi? You'll still think I'm a good teacher? Well, then I'll tell you. But only if you promise me. Now, how am I going to know for sure you're not going to view me differently? How am I going to know? I mean, we need to build a trust. We need to develop trust. What does it mean? How could you accept me? How could you not think differently of me? If I tell you my flaws, how could you not think differently of me? Here you thought I was this perfect rabbi, and now I'm going to tell you all of my flaws. It's going to have to change. How could you possibly think of one another the same?
Because we share the common flaws, and often our flaws are the same. It actually can make us closer, because we realize we're really not above you so much. You and I are more alike.
Good. Excellent.
Well, I think that if you can accept yourself in your totality, with your flaws and all parts of yourself, and if you can forgive yourself and gentle with yourself, and you can do that with other people. And I think it is true that the more people, I mean, speaking generally, that if people open up to me and let me know their flaws, I am more accepting than I am. I then can accept more of myself too. So it's to accept you. Okay.
Yes.
It's only valid if you're willing to accept more.
Well, that's what you said.
That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what you said, right?
Well,
I know I mess up every day. It's not that I love you.
Well, accepting.
I'm willing to accept that that's the way I am.
I think for most of us, we have what's called self-love. And of course, there are parts of us that we have a hard time accepting. But most of us, we accept. And so we're okay. Because, like you said, it's part of being human. And it's something that I'm working on. It's not me. It's not me. And so the same thing, when I tell you my flaw, I should not change in your eyes. Because my flaw is not me. it's a failing, it's something that I've done wrong or whatever it is, but it's not me. You still like me. I'm still the same. I'm still the same person. So why, when you hear the flaw, do you think that the flaw is me? I'm not my flaw. I'm a person. I'm a human being with feelings, with caring, with love, with, I have so many wonderful qualities. Why you think that I'm a flaw? I'm not. So if I tell you the flaw, then all you see is the flaw. You forget that I'm a person. But when you hear the flaw, you go, oh, that's not you. And that's what it means here, that they turned away, they didn't look, and when they did look, they didn't see their father's nakedness, they didn't see the flaw, they didn't change their opinion of their father. Their father still remained the same in their eyes. The flaw that he had, the mistakes that he made, didn't change their opinion of him one iota. Sichem, on the other hand, and Canaan, when they walked in, what did they see? They saw a flaw, and it changed their opinion of their father. They thought lower of their father. They thought their father was not holy anymore. They thought of him differently. The flaw changed their opinion of their father. That is a fatal mistake in relationships. That in the relationship that we have with other human beings, we are not allowed to allow their flaws to cloud our vision of the other person. We must always look at the other person as a person and not allow the flaw to become who you think they are. And so this is the message, the unbelievable, powerful habit of faith that comes out of this lesson is the way we are supposed to look at other human beings, and especially the people that are closest to us, our spouse, our children, our parents, especially honoring your parents. What does it mean to honor your parents? Honoring your parents means that no matter what they do, you still honor them, no matter what. It doesn't say in the Bible, respect your parents if they deserve it. Correct. Very hard. I'm not talking about physical and sexual abuse because that's a little extreme. But I'm not talking about that.
What happens in that case?
That's a good question. I have to say that for another time.
Okay.
Only because it's too painful. Because if anybody here has experienced that, it's too painful to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to leave that alone. So we can just intellectually talk about it. And intellectually we can talk about the abuse that we've all had from our parents. It's just natural abuse that we have because parents are flawed people. They're just people trying to be parents, and so they make mistakes. And so the flaw should never allow us to see our parents differently. Honor father and mother regardless. In the Talmud, by the way, it says, just to throw this out there, and yes, if your parents hit you in the face in front of your whole crowd, you're in the middle of the rabbi, you're giving a speech, and your mother slaps you across the face, you're not allowed to be disrespectful to them. Because I don't think it says, love your parents. This is where people make a mistake. It doesn't say, love your parents. It says, honor them. Respect them. Respect is an action. It's something you got to do. It's a respectful action. So, if my parent is abusive, I don't have to stick around to be abused, but am I allowed to hit them back? Am I allowed to curse them? Am I allowed to hit them? Absolutely not under any circumstance am I ever allowed to do that. So that's kind of the difference, the position that the Torah takes as far as no matter what the abuse is, you can't be abusive back to them. You don't have to take the abuse, but you remove yourself from that situation. But as far as respecting them, don't, and it goes for everyone, any relationship that you have. And it becomes harder with your parents. It's harder with a spouse, harder with children, because you live with them, you spend your life with them. They do things to you that can hurt you this is much more of a difficult situation, a much more difficult relationship. And therefore, it is so important and critical that we don't allow the flaw to become them. One of the great rabbis used to say that when you look at someone else, you're actually looking at a mirror. You're looking at a mirror. And the flaws you see in someone else are actually your own flaws. And so, the righteous never see any flaws. They never see you as a flawed human being. They never connect the flaw to you. They always separate the person out of the flaw. And the rest of us struggle with that. And that's because, the reason is because we have flaws. And we see our flaws in other people. The other person is a mirror to you. So if you see negative qualities in somebody else, that's because you have that negative quality. So what are you supposed to do? What are you supposed to do when you see someone who has a negative quality? Don't think of the negative quality. Think of how you can help them. So don't focus on them as they are a problem, they are a flaw. But rather, how can I help them through this difficulty that they're going through? Because if you don't see people's flaws, you're probably blind and you won't be able to help anybody. You need to notice their flaws. They noticed that their father was naked. They knew that he needed to be taken care of, and they went in there to go help him. In counseling, many people come and, come to the rabbi to try to get advice on what's going on in their relationships, what's going on in their life, spousal, parent-child, child-parent relationships. Can you imagine I'm sitting there, and I have to hear all these terrible things about other people? How am I supposed to look that person in the face when the spouse just came in and told me all these horrible things about the other one, what they did? How am I going to look the guy in the face? How am I look her in the face? How am I going to talk to this? What am I supposed to do? How are you supposed to exercise this where I don't see the nakedness, but they just told me the nakedness? I mean, they just told me what they did. Well, what am I supposed to do? What are we supposed to do when we hear all these things? So, okay, better not, y'all won't hear, or y'all not going to listen. Not going to listen. How are you going to help the person? How are you going to help? How are you going to be able to counsel someone if you don't hear what happened? So what happened? Okay, don't tell me all the details. Don't tell me all the names. I mean, I don't have to, but something they need to know. So how am I supposed to not view the person differently? How do you do that? How do you separate that out? This is a difficult thing in life, to separate people out of their flaws, so that when you see the person next time, you don't think of them as, oh, that's the guy who did that to his wife. Oh, or that's the guy, or that's the woman who did this to her husband. Oh, my gosh, I guess I won't be able to say hello to anybody. So the first thing is, I always tell people when they come to counsel, I tell them, whatever you're going to say, I don't believe you. I don't believe you. It's not true. Whatever you say is not true. Your spouse didn't do it. Your parents didn't do it. Your child didn't do it. It's not true. Now that I've told you what I don't believe you, now you can go ahead and tell me whatever it is you want, and I will counsel you based on the information you're going to tell me. Because if I were to believe you, how would I ever look at your spouse ever again? I won't be able to do this. And I say it in jest, but I really mean it, because the truth is, what someone tells me is simply their perspective of what happened. I really don't know what happened, and neither does anybody know what happened, because you experience something. You experience what you think happened, but did it really happen? Did it really happen exactly the way you said it? And what precipitated it to happen? I couldn't believe it. I mean, it's only because I've been doing this for many years that I actually have proof for them now. I used to say that, you have to wait to hear the other side of the story before you can judge. Now I don't even have to wait to hear the other side of the story, because many times the people themselves tell me the other side of the story. I mean, someone recently was just telling me how how terrible their spouse, what they were doing, and I was going, oh my gosh, no. And I always counsel people based on what they tell me. Listen, based on what the information you're telling me, then you need to do this and this and this and this. I mean, if it's true, I don't know if it's true, I cannot, I'm telling you I don't believe that it happened. But if you believe that it happened, then this is probably what you should do. And then they drop the line. I go, huh? You did that? No wonder. No wonder. I mean, now everything makes sense. Of course, I knew. I should have known not to believe you. See, and I don't believe you. Of course, you did that. They did this. They make perfect sense. Nobody's bad here. They're all good people. And it's true. It's really true. Most people are good people. But we get into relationships and we start to do things and we hurt each other and we don't communicate properly and we do other things and things escalate and go out of control I really don't believe you. And this way, it helps me because when I see the person, I just keep on just repeating it in my head. I don't know what happened. I don't know for sure what happened. I wasn't there. I don't know. I was counseling the person trying to help. I was being there to help, not being there as a peeping Tom to see what goes on in somebody else's house, in somebody else's bedroom. I don't want to know, and I don't want to be involved in that. I want to be involved in helping the person in their pain and trying to see a different perspective so that they can then go through life in a way that they won't see the flaws in other people, that they'll view other people positively. That's what I want to help people do. So I will sit there and listen, but I'm not going to believe you because then I will be perpetrating the crime of actually seeing their nakedness, which is something I don't want to do. I don't want to do it in counseling. I don't want to do it in interpersonal relationships. And it's something that we all, that's the habit of faith that we all need to embrace, is not to look at other people's nakedness for the sake of, you know, looky-loos, you know, to see what's going on in somebody else's life. So, oh, they got problems too in their marriage. Oh, nice to know. I'm not the only one with problems. Oh, it's nice to know they got problems with this and with problems with this. No, I'm not interested in that. I want you, you have a good marriage. You're a good person. You're both great people. You're wonderful people. You're just having trouble, and I'm going to try to help you with your trouble. And let me see how I can help and feel your pain, understand your pain, and try to help you be strong so that you don't get sucked into this cycle that's going on in your relationship. I can try to help you break out of it. And so the habit of faith is, this week, till you come back, you're going to start looking at people, number one, as a mirror. When you see a flaw in someone else, you're going to say, why did I see that flaw in someone? It's probably because I am harboring that flaw somewhere inside of me. And if I do know someone's flaw, to not believe it. To not believe it as a flaw, not to believe that they are the flaw, but rather what they did was wrong, but that's not them. That's not the person. Don't make the person into all you see now. You know, it's like that's what one of the greatest sins in Jewish tradition is gossip. Gossiping is one of the worst sins. Why? You can take a perfectly beautiful person, and through gossip, everyone is convinced this is the most horrible person in the world. Because all that, you know, next time you see that person, it's going to be hard to look at them and go, oh, I used to think you were a nice guy, but now I saw all those other things, you heard all those other things you did. They're true. They're true things, but now it's distorted my picture of you. That's what gossip does. Gossip destroys, absolutely destroys relationships and destroys the way we look at other people. And I'll end with a story about gossip. Of this fellow who was a gossiper and caused a lot of problems with his gossip and decided that it was time to make amends. And so he went to the rabbi and he said, Rabbi, you know, I've sinned and I've been so destructive. I've caused so many marriages to fall apart. I've hurt so many people and I've done terrible, terrible things in my life. But just with my gossip, just with the words that I've said. And now, I'd like to make amends. I said, no problem. Do you have a pillow with down feathers in it? Oh, yes, oh, for sure. Okay, well, I want you to take it to the highest point in the city on the windiest day, and I want you to cut the pillow open and just let those feathers fly. That's it? I said, yeah, that's it. Just do that, and then come back to me, and I'll tell you what to do next. And so he goes up, and he... And, of course, he makes sure to shake out every single, I mean, the rabbi said, and he shakes out every single last feather, and sure enough, it scatters all over the place. He comes back to the rabbi and says, "Nu, how did it go?" He said, "I did such a good job, I'm telling you." He said, "Okay, now I want you to go and collect every feather." Impossible! Same thing. Impossible for you to repent for the gossip you did, because you have to go back and repair. You know, you don't even know what the effect of your gossip was. It had such a terrible, terrible impact on so many people's lives. Why is gossip so terrible? Because it changes our perception of other people. It's a sin to gossip. It's an even bigger sin to hear gossip. To listen to it is even worse. So hearing gossip is not just, "Well, I didn't do anything wrong." You are listening to it. You're actually worse than the person who's actually saying it. So put it on your list, on your habits of faith. No gossip. You shouldn't say gossip. And when other people gossip around you, say, "Excuse me, no smoking in here. Secondhand smoke kills. Gossip kills. No gossip." I won't answer that question. You can choose what to read and what not to read. And there is something about something which is public knowledge is really not gossip. But I will tell you this: public gossip, which is allowed, is not good for your soul. Just think of it in those terms. It's like good decay. Like decay of your teeth when you eat too much candy. Gossip, even if it's kosher gossip, not good for your soul. Yeah, kosher gossip is if it's public knowledge that everybody knows, then it's not considered gossip, but it's called kosher gossip, which is still not good for your soul. It's like cotton candy, you know. So it's not good for you. But, yes. Excellent question. So first of all, you have to replace, you know, it's like if you try to forget the word hippopotamus, try to erase the word hippopotamus from your vocabulary. How do you? You can't erase it. It's not possible. You can't erase a word by intentionally forgetting it. The way you transform a emotion or a feeling that's been created by someone is to replace it with another one. So you have to focus on something positive about the person. That has to become now the picture of that person. And I'll tell you something, just an interesting thing about human nature, and that is, if you haven't seen if you have a friend you see every once in a while, only tell them good news. Because if you tell them bad news, the next time they see you, they go, how did that thing work out? Did that work out okay? You're like, "What thing?" "Oh, that. Oh yeah, it was so long ago." They're like, "Well, that was the last time we had a communication. Things were tough, and so every time your name came up, something tough. The picture came up because that's what I associated with. We've associated those two things. So if you leave off with a good note and you tell them good news, then the association is something good. So you have to replace the association of that person with something good. That's the only way you can't get into your mind, "I'm going to forget this picture." You'll never forget the picture. only if you replace it with other pictures, eventually it pushes that picture out, till it finally falls off. So it's not that I'm going to push the picture out, but I can replace it with a good picture of that person and start to think positively about that person. Correct. And then I could say, wow, you know, they really are a good person. And therefore, that other thing that I was told about them, listen, I don't know the real story. I don't know the full story. I don't know everything about it. And I'm sure the guy has a flaw. And you know what? We've all got flaws. I've got a flaw too. And I would want people to accept me with my flaw, just like I want that person probably wants to be accepted with their flaw also. And so that's kind of the way to turn that around. Yeah, it sounds like we got the entire fire department from Orange County going somewhere. That's not a good, yeah. Yeah, by Jewish law, if all the judges, they didn't have juries in those days, they still don't in Jewish courts, If all the judges found someone unanimously guilty, that person would not get a death penalty. So the only way to get a death penalty was if it was not a unanimous decision. That's good. I'm glad you don't understand. No, I would worry about you if you thought it made sense. How could that possibly make sense to you? But if you understand that the whole purpose of the capital punishment was to atone, well, this guy is so bad, even killing him ain't going to help. Now, that only applies in certain cases, by the way. But in most cases, you need a majority, not a unanimous decision. So that just shows you an insight into the capital punishment. The way Judaism looks at it is that it was done to help the person, as opposed to, if you know your Bible story, when David is on his deathbed, what does he tell Solomon to do? The first thing, what's the first order that Solomon's supposed to do? He's 12 years old and he becomes king. What's his first order to do? Kill two people. First of all, why is he getting his son to do his dirty work? Okay, these are people who had sinned against him. Why did he kill them? Obviously, if they deserve a death penalty, why did he do it? And the answer is, it was for their own benefit. To kill someone in Jewish tradition was to help the person. Obviously, they had done something so terrible that they were not going to make it into the next world. They had done something so terrible that the only way they could be cleansed of it was through this punishment. And so, again, it's a whole different way of viewing it. Therefore, when we don't view it that way, there's a question of whether it's being used properly. So that's where it gets complicated. When people aren't doing it for that reason, then are they doing it for the right reason? And if they're not doing it for the right reason, are they doing it right? Are they using the right criteria? And therefore, is it being done properly? So that brings a whole other question, and we have to use a Torah criteria for it to make sure we're on the right path. I think our time is up. But we'll take one last question. Yes.
So that means that in the U.S., capital punishment is required as it relates to the breach of money. You know, never actually happened. That was by Jewish law, and it was the whole thing.
Again, you're trying to put two separate sets of laws and try to compare them to each other. So the American legal system works very differently than the Jewish legal system. There are a lot of similarities, but they're based on different axioms and different foundations, and therefore you can't apply what works in one necessarily to work always in the other. So it doesn't necessarily cross over because the whole court system is set up differently. If it was set up exactly like the Jewish one, I would say yes. But it's not set up that way. It's set up differently. It's set up by preponderance. It's set up. There's all different types of requirements. Okay. Next week is our last meeting together, and we're going to try to tackle the power of Babel. That's going to be very interesting.